Working through our recent verse-by-verse study of Jude, that there were some subjects in that short letter that I was eager to spend some time on. And some of those subjects that he just sort of mentions them in passing, and since they were not instrumental to the points he was focusing on, he didn't really elaborate on them any, and therefore it seemed to be a little bit out of line to address them during the exegetical part of our study, for that could kind of imply that they were significant to Jude's train of thought. Now, I'm not sure how many of those subjects from this letter that I'm actually going to be taking on in the weeks and months to come. There are three for sure that I am committed to, and I had previously announced them, and so let me go over them again with you. There is the subject of homosexuality. Jude refers to the judgment of Sodom and Gomorrah and the sin of defiling the flesh. There's also the subject of eternal punishment. And actually, this is something that Jude mentions a number of times. And though he is quite direct in his warnings about God's judgment, he doesn't really take the time to explain or elaborate on it. The doctrine of hell, I think a lot of you realize, is pretty much under attack quite a bit today. And so this is especially by leaders in many evangelical churches. They're actually questioning the whole thing. And so this is something I've been eager to address for some time. And the third one is the historicity of Adam. You will remember that Jude quotes a prophecy from Enoch and identifies that particular Enoch as the one who is the seventh from Adam. And so the question is, was there an actual Adam, a first man, or is the language in Genesis kind of mythological, a sort of expanded parable, if you will, that simply serves to represent the beginning of mankind? Now, of the three subjects, this one here will no doubt be the most challenging to prepare for as a speaker and for you to follow along as a listener. Here we will need to respond to some recent claims from some of the leading scientists that the human race, according to recent junk DNA research, descended from perhaps thousands of primates rather than one pair of ancestors, as scientists had previously thought. And so this particular theory is actually a tweaking of the standard evolutionary model. And one of the reasons I'm interested in addressing this is because a number of leading evangelical Christian scientists are endorsing this theory, and it has become quite a topic in academic circles, quite controversial. And except for John Shutt, we will probably have a hard time grasping all the science involved, but we should be aware at least of the gist of the various arguments for and against. Both Christianity Today and World Magazine have devoted issues to this controversy. So, John, I'm probably going to drag you up here and help out with some of this when we get to that point. But at this point, that's probably going to be a couple years away because all of this is going to occupy a lot of time. And maybe by then it won't be controversial anymore. All right, so which of these three do we do first? Well, given all the record-breaking 100-degree temperatures this week, the choice seems pretty obvious, don't you think? I thought that we could all take our chairs outside in the parking lot, sit under the solar rays, and that'd be a good teaching effect, good teaching aid, visual effect for eternal, huh? For what? Yeah, for fire and brimstone. I thought that would be the way to go. Well, actually, what you see on the outline here on the screen is what I intend to go with. Today, we will start with the series on homosexuality, and then the others will follow that. And the whole fires of hell thing will have to wait until it's about 30 degrees outside, of which the points then won't be that effective, but that's kind of how it falls together. All right. The reason should be in a blank slide there. That's okay. The reason for doing a series on homosexuality is pretty obvious. I'm quite confident that everyone here knows someone who is either quietly struggling with this or is openly living a homosexual lifestyle. We may or may not know exactly how to interact with them about that. Secondly, we probably have some of our own folks here who fight their own personal battles in this area as well, who struggle with same-sex desires. And if the current research is correct, and that's kind of an if, but if it is true, then there are actually more people who experience these sorts of things than what we might think. And so the question is, how should we respond? What should be our demeanor and attitude and approach toward anyone struggling with this sort of thing? Also, number three, as you know, homosexuality is on the forefront of the cultural war right now, and practically every other day the sanctity of marriage suffers another setback as gay activists successfully push forward their agenda. And there is more here than just the moral legitimization of homosexuality in our culture. It is also about the delegitimizing of Christian morality. And how then should Christians respond to this dismantling of Christian morals in our society? And another reason, perhaps the most important reason that a series on this subject is fitting, is because of the ignorance and confusion that exists about this subject. Many Christians do not really know what they believe. They are ignorant of what the Bible actually teaches. They are pulled in all sorts of directions. They're not equipped to engage others and often frame their arguments on points that in the end backfire on them. And there's actually quite a bit involved in this issue, and we can't afford to embrace faulty thinking about it. All right, now there are other reasons for tackling this subject, but these here are some of the main ones. Today is more or less an introduction, so let's begin by establishing some basic definitions. I'm using the words unnatural relations as the title of this series, and these words are taken directly from Romans 1. Unnatural relations is descriptive, and it reinforces the fact that contrary to what Hollywood and the media and our courts and our educational systems and now our military and much of our government and leading corporations and unfortunately a significant part of the modern church, contrary to what all of these major movers and shakers of our society say, homosexual behavior is not natural. It's what the Bible says. It is not a gift. It is not a source of pride. It is unnatural. It is not how God designed us physically or emotionally or relationally or spiritually. And furthermore, those who give themselves over to it are giving themselves over to, another quote from Romans 1, shameful lust. And acts committed are declared by God in that same chapter as, quote, indecent and perversions. When I use the word homosexuality, I'll be using it according to the standard dictionary definition, sexual desire or behavior directed toward a person of one's own sex. The word homosexual, however, is a word that I specifically reserve for those who actually give themselves over to these desires. Now, that may involve actual sexual encounters or a non-sexual romantic relationship or gratification through pornography or even the fixation of lustful fantasies. But the emphasis here is not on the same-sex attraction itself or mere desires. It specifically involves the yielding to those attractions and desires. They are played out in some fashion. Or, to put it in biblical language, they have gone from the stage of temptation to that of actual sin. All right, now, because this is such an important distinction and one that is crucial to this series, let me take a moment to illustrate it. A thief is not a thief if the thought occurs to him to take the wallet sitting on the counter, or even if he has a desire to take it. He becomes a thief the moment he grabs it. It's the behavior, not the desire, that the Bible condemns. It's the act itself that makes him a thief. Likewise, it's the behavior, not the desire, that makes one a homosexual. And this is very important to remember, and we'll talk more about that in 2 weeks. All right, now for the word gay. This word is often used as a euphemism for homosexuality, and the two words have virtually become synonymous. And because it's shorter and easier to say and sounds more positive, it has become the more popular word to use. However, in the earlier days, gay originally referred to someone who had come out of the closet, who was no longer hiding their homosexuality. And so in this series, I will use the word in that context, as in referring to things like the gay rights agenda, something that's out in the open, or the pro-gay gospel, or gays who march in a gay pride parade, that sort of thing. Basically, gays are homosexuals who aren't ashamed of it. Therefore, all gays are homosexual, but not all homosexuals are gay. And gays are the ones who are currently steering our culture on this issue. Not every gay is a political activist, but the fact that he or she is in a homosexual relationship and pulls no punches about it makes them an activist nonetheless. Because in all of this, they are, of course, helping to further the political agenda of the gay rights movement. Also in this series, just a point of clarification, I'll be more interested in keeping the focus on what we might call mainstream homosexuality. Therefore, I'm probably not going to say that much about other sexual deviations that are often considered to be related. The same points would more or less apply to those as well. And also, while we're at it, while I mentioned earlier during the announcement time, I'm going to give this series an official MPAA rating. It's not all that uncommon for some parents to have their children remain with the adults for the sermons, and you're certainly welcome to do that, but a warning would be in order. I don't intend to get graphic. I will be treating this material on a level intended for adults. And these sermons won't be as explicit as a PG-13 movie, but if you don't let your kids watch PG-13 movies, then you probably won't want them listening to the sermons. All right, in preparing for this series, I started collecting a few stories which serve as signs of the times. I thought that might be appropriate during the introduction. I gathered these from newspapers and magazines, and they're all quite recent, all from within just the past 2 months. I wanted to try to keep it as current as I could. We've already have talked about the first one. This is certainly a significant sign of the time. And I talked about the Sunday after it happened. The President of the United States has publicly given his support to same-sex marriage and has done so citing the teachings of Jesus as part of his reasoning. A week and a half ago, the President had a reception for gay activists at the White House. This was a first, never been done before, and it was part of recognizing the month of June as Gay Pride Month. Now, some of these activists had their pictures taken under the official portrait of Ronald Reagan. Each president has their portrait there in the White House. And in those pictures, which I have seen, these activists were giving President Reagan the finger. Now, mind you, this is a first-class reception in the White House of the United States. And they are standing before these honorable portraits of past presidents, making obscene gestures to Reagan in particular. This is a photo op for them. What's especially puzzling about this is that Reagan never once addressed the issue of homosexuality. In fact, we have absolutely no idea what his position was on that. Another sign of the times, two different federal appeals courts have now ruled the Defense of Marriage Act is unconstitutional. Now, I want you to think about that for a moment. I would have to wonder, what is it in the Constitution of the United States that would prohibit the definition of marriage as between one man and one woman? What could possibly be found in that to come to such a conclusion? And so, again, it's tragic here. I mean, we continue the tragedy of the courts treating the Constitution like it's a magician's hat. You can just pull anything out of it that you want to, out of nothing. A month ago, the first same-sex ceremony was held on a military base. Are these lining up? I can't hardly read that back there. Okay. And along with that, the Pentagon officially observed this past month, June, as Gay Pride Month. This one's troubling. The Republican Party of Indiana will not, this time around, endorse marriage as between one man and one woman in their platform. They will take no position on same-sex unions or marriages. And they also dropped the sanctity of life language that was part of their platform in previous years. Also, this past month, California, you may have heard of this, is moving proposed laws through the legislature that would make reparative therapy illegal. Counselors would be prohibited by law from offering a course of treatment designed to help minors struggling with same-sex attraction to overcome those desires or to try to decrease them. And in treating adults, counselors will have to provide a consent form acknowledging that such treatment is both ineffective and dangerous. The media made a big deal this week of two different celebrities who have now gone public. Is it still lining up? The first was CNN TV personality Anderson Cooper, and this announcement apparently was not that big of a surprise. The other one was hip-hop singer Frank Ocean. Since hip-hop is traditionally not that accepting of homosexuality, the fact that he would make such an announcement was seen as a rather bold move, and he was saluted for his courage in that. I don't have cable TV. I never watched CNN. I don't know anything about this Cooper guy, and I'm completely ignorant of what goes on in the hip-hop world. I don't even know what hip-hop even is. And so, admittedly, I failed to appreciate the significance of these announcements, but the media assured me that they were both very big stories. So that's why you're getting them today. At their last shareholders meeting, just a few weeks ago, Home Depot shrugged off over 700,000 signatures on a petition presented to them, pleading the superstore to remain neutral on the issue of same-sex marriage. The chairman made it very clear that the corporation will continue on its present course. Home Depot participates in gay pride parades around the nation, and they even solicit children to ride on their floats in those parades. And they give thousands of dollars every year to organizations that work aggressively toward legalizing same-sex marriage. They are so committed to the cause that boycotts involving hundreds of thousands of potential customers didn't faze them at all. Another sign of the times, as you know, you saw this in the news, General Motors salutes June as Gay Pride Month by flying the rainbow flag in front of their facility just a few miles here on I-69. Actually, endless examples could be given of corporations doing these sorts of things, but this next one is really disheartening. Kraft Foods, in their support for Gay Pride Month, posts on their Facebook page the Gay Oreo Cookie. And it looks like this. It actually looks kind of yummy when you look at it, but I don't think I could ever eat another Oreo cookie because this is really troublesome. The president, this was shocking when I read this, of the Institute for American Values, the chief witness who testified in favor of California's ban of gay marriage, announced a week ago he regrets his involvement in those efforts, that he was wrong in all that, and now supports same-sex marriage. 300 heterosexual Mormons marched with their families in a gay pride parade in Salt Lake City last month. Now, you know things are really bad when there's a gay pride parade in the Mormon capital of the world. And it's especially bad when Mormons march in it. And now the best for last, or I should say the worst for last, and this one really grieved me. It doesn't really have that much effect, but it just grieved me nonetheless. So admit that I am not a Green Lantern fan and don't know anything about him, but still I found it disturbing. We have the comic book hero, the role model for our youth, has now proposed to his boyfriend and has declared to the world that he is gay. So you have to wonder, who's next? Batman? Spider-Man? Frodo? You know, Aslan, who are they going to be messing with next? All right, I probably missed a whole bunch of other similar events that could serve as signs of the times, but these are the ones that I came across. A couple years from now, someone might be listening to this MP3 sermon, and they will probably think that these examples here are all pretty lame and mild compared to what they will be dealing with at that time, because we have no idea. We have no idea of what is about to come. We really don't. And as you know, all of these advancements have religious liberty ramifications as well. Christians are constantly under threat of losing their jobs, of suffering great harassment, of getting sued, and sometimes of the threat of even being charged with a hate crime if they dare to condemn homosexual behavior or simply express their disagreement or disapproval. The pressure is going to come. It's really going to heat up. It's really going to intensify. And it's not contrary to, you know, this sort of misplaced idea that a lot of Christians have. You know, it's not the stuff you see in the movies where soldiers break down the front door, hold a gun to your head and say, deny Christ or die. You know, it's not really going to be that sort of thing. That may come, but before we get to that point, it's going to be things like, If you openly condemn homosexual behavior from your pulpit or in your classrooms at church or on your website or in your literature, you will lose your tax-exempt status. How many churches will stand firm in the face of that? I have to wonder. If you use church funds to support organizations that seek to ban same-sex marriages, you will be subjected to the universal diversity tax. You know, they take 80% of what's in your account. Or they'll say, of course you can teach from the Bible, provided that you do not publicly read or comment from the following passages, of which the state will provide their list of all that's off limits. If an individual displays a bumper sticker that advertises marriage as one man and one woman, the driver will be charged with a hate crime, and the vehicle will be seized. I mean, it may not exactly look like that, but it might. But whatever it is, it's going to be pretty tough. We're going to be faced with some pretty tough choices coming up here, and I hope that we all have the resolve to choose wisely. It's going to get tough. It really is. In many ways, Christians themselves need to shoulder a good deal of the responsibility for this mess. Not all of it, but certainly some of it. And a whole case could be made about our apathy and lack of involvement in standing against the agenda, which has allowed to triumph in our land. But I actually think that the fault lies more on the overall lack of honor and respect that many, many Christians have for the marriage institution itself. By their attitudes and actions, many who confess Christ have failed to uphold the sacredness of marriage as God's holy institution. Sins like premarital sex, adultery, pornography, along with an extremely loose view of divorce, have all, along with homosexual unions, contributed to the grinding away of marriage as a sacred institution. And so basically, how can we expect our pagan culture to respect marriage when we in the church who name the name of Christ fail to respect it as we should? I'll talk more about this next week. The fact is, it is often easier to fight for our principles than it is to live up to them. All right, at this time, let me share with you a brief outline of what we will be covering in the weeks to come. Kind of prepare you for this, and this outline will probably, it might actually change a little bit along the way, but at least it'll give you a sense of the topics I plan to tackle and the kind of the direction I intend to take. Next week, we will launch into what might be called the family quarrel. That is, the quarrel of what a family actually is. Does Scripture offer a concise definition of the family? If so, is that definition critical to a doctrinal moral issue within the church? And are we called to promote and defend that definition outside the church? In part three, Is that right now? Part three, we'll try to grasp a right understanding of the nature of homosexuality itself. We'll tackle questions like what causes it? Are people born with it? Is there a cure? It seems that many people have at least some level of same-sex attraction, even if they live heterosexual lives. So why is this the case? And what do I do if I experience same-sex desires? Does that mean that I am destined to be a homosexual? And is there a way to make those desires go away? And so forth. In the next part, we'll look at the various responses from the modern church to homosexuality, and there are many different responses. We have pro-gay churches that actually promote same-sex marriage. Mostly these would be in the liberal camp, of course. And we have, even in conservative evangelical churches, those that are quite permissive on this, or at best ambiguous. They don't want to take a stand, and this is somewhat of a recent development, and it's becoming quickly a trend. On the other end of the spectrum would be judgmental churches. They would uphold the truth, but they do so harshly and without compassion, often turning away those who are open to discussion and possibly wanting help, and therefore in that such churches are actually unfaithful to the truth. And then there are churches that are just ignorant on the subject and or uncommitted, and they just don't want to deal with it. And so in that part there, we will strive to discover how a church should respond. In part five, we'll spend a couple weeks looking at relevant Bible passages. We'll especially be interested in how those in the pro-gay movement within the modern church have reinterpreted these passages, these revisions, and those of you in Denny's hermeneutics class will have an opportunity here to test your skills. Included in this section, we'll also look at the theological arguments that are used. In fact, This is primarily where acceptance for homosexual behavior in the church is making the most headway. Not really on the biblical grounds, although that's a contributing factor, but it's the theological arguments. Convincing people that God is either indifferent or that because of his unconditional love, he actually approves. In the next section, I'll continue down this road looking at some of the major arguments used outside the church to influence our society at large to not only tolerate but to actually endorse and support homosexual behavior. We'll then take a week or two to wrestle with real-life situations, common scenarios that often come up. Some in our congregation have faced these. Something like, my sister is a lesbian, wants to bring her girlfriend to our Thanksgiving dinner, which will be held at my house this year. You know, what do I do? You know, this type of stuff. There's lots of those sorts of scenarios, and we want to look at that. Next, we'll look at the gay agenda and how they have become so effective and where they are headed and why we should be concerned. And finally, is that number 9? I'll talk about our proper response as not only good Christians, but also as good citizens. Paul exhorted the Ephesians to stand against the schemes of the devil. Though Paul wasn't specifically referring to their battle against the advancements of the gay agenda in their culture, the expression does seem appropriate nonetheless, because all that is going on today, behind that, of course, are forces of evil in the spiritual realm. And so we need to be wise in how we respond as God's servants and also as God's ambassadors. We need to know how to pick our battles when it comes to the courts and Congress and how to maximize our efforts in those battles. And not just in the legal front, but also in our schools and places of employment and neighborhoods and on it goes. You know, how can we best influence our society in this area? Again, it's often easier to fight for our principles than it is to live up to them. And to influence our society means that we will have to do both. Now, as you can see, this series is going to take a little while. And even in this, my plan is to keep things at a fairly basic level. There's all sorts of things here that we could spend time on that we won't be able to. And in closing here, let me spend just a couple minutes to... Do I have time? 10 after. Okay, this won't take long. Let me spend just a couple minutes here on the Bible's approach to human sexuality. I got 5 principles that will be useful in our series here, and it kind of seems appropriate to close out our introduction to this series with them. First, as you know, we are created beings. If we weren't created, this is what's significant here, and therefore answer to no creator, well, we could judge for ourselves what is right and wrong. And just go with that. But since we are created, then we are accountable to our Maker, and what he says counts more than what we think or feel. And since God is there, then it doesn't matter what is preferred. It only matters what is true. We're going to have to keep that before us. Secondly, our Creator has specific intentions for our existence and behavior, which are spelled out in Scripture. Thirdly, these intentions are extended to our relationships in general and to our sexual relationships in particular. It should be noted that not only did God create us as human beings, but as sexual beings as well. He authored our male-female distinctives and our capacity for erotic pleasure, then looked on all that he had created and said, "That is good." So far from being prudish or anti-sexual, God is the author and the original celebrator of sex. And understanding this, again, is important when approaching our whole series, but also the next point here. And that is this, number 4, sexual behaviors falling short of God's intent are serious enough to warrant public rebuke from Matthew 14 and church discipline, 1 Corinthians 5, and are considered detrimental in ways that are unique and severe, 1 Corinthians 6, where we are told that sexual sins, unlike other sins, is a sin against one's own body. And Paul goes on to exhort his readers to honor God with their bodies. So God finds sexual sin abhorrent precisely because he views healthy sex as being so exquisite and meaningful. And while we must regard all sin as serious, sexual sin carries a severity in both its nature and consequences. And number 5, the specific sexual sin of homosexuality is prohibited in both the Old and New Testaments and is regarded as one of many sexual behaviors falling short of God's intent, along with adultery, fornication, prostitution, and incest. And if we are indeed created with and for specific intentions, and if sin falls short of those intentions, and if sexual sin falls short in ways that especially offends our Creator, not to mention the havoc it brings to our own lives, and if homosexuality in particular constitutes sexual sin, then homosexuality clearly matters. Thus the reason for this series. It matters to God, and therefore it should matter to the church. All right, we'll stand at this time. We'll bring the children in. I think it's safe at this point to bring them in. And we'll have the musicians come forward, and we'll continue our service this morning, worshiping the Lord in song.